Alaska Public Media's Every Little Bit recognizes people who go above and beyond to strengthen our community in Anchorage and South Central Alaska.
I think if someone wants to start a community event, they should just go for it.
I believe in serving your neighbor, love one another.
There's always something that you can do.
Wherever people meet one another's needs, all of us are enriched by that.
Do you know someone doing good in your community? Nominate them at alaskapublic.org/littlebit.
We expect you to take strong action. I think how we do that is by having those shutdown periods during the peak of the run.
The Board of Fisheries approves restrictions to allow more chum salmon to reach the Yukon and Kuskokwim rivers. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, February 26th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Alaska businesses express relief at the Supreme Court tariff ruling, but they don't expect refunds.
Is Ermin Skate, a little tiny Nordic skate making company in Alaska, going to be first in line to receive refunds on their unconstitutional tariff charges?
The PFD application is open. Just a small amount of your PFD will help share local news and stories about Alaskans with Alaskans across this great state when you choose Alaska Public Media through Pick, Click, Give.
The Alaska Board of Fisheries wrapped up its week-long meeting in Anchorage Wednesday when it approved new limits for the South Alaska Peninsula salmon fishery. It's part of a broader effort to reduce the interception of chum salmon bound for the Yukon and Kuskokwim rivers, where salmon returns have reached crisis lows. The region is part of Area M, a commercial fishing district that runs along the Alaska Peninsula and into the eastern Aleutians. The board's action reduces fishing opportunities in Area M by about a third, cutting 136 hours for the drift fleet and 94 hours for the seine fleet during the most important fishing times for the commercial sector. The Tanana Chiefs Conference, a consortium of dozens of native tribes in western and interior Alaska, called the decision a major step for Yukon River communities. The nonprofit has advocated for stricter regulations in Area M for years. Chief Chair Brian Ridley asked the board on Tuesday to shift more conservation responsibility onto the commercial sector.
We expect you to take strong action. I think how we do that is by having those shutdown periods during the peak of the run.
But Area M fishermen say they're already stretched thin. Area M Seiners Association President Kylie Thompson said in an interview that the new measures would effectively wipe out the entire June fishery, which is when the fleet earns the majority of its income.
So now what we're left with is we get about 8 or 9 days to fish in the month of June. Basically, we were given a rope to hang ourselves with.
Communities like Sand Point and King Cove, whose entire economies revolve around commercial fishing, have been hit hard by low prices, poor harvests, and market turmoil in recent years. King Cove lost its only seafood processing plant 3 years ago and continues to struggle economically. The Area M Seiners Association has warned that tighter restrictions would hurt their sector, which they say is already fighting for survival. The Board of Fisheries voted 4-3 in favor of the new restrictions, which go into effect this summer. A state task force released recommendations this month for making psychedelic therapy available if treatments are approved at the federal level. The state legislature established the task force in 2024 to examine the therapies, which hold a lot of promise but are still considered experimental. Jenny Armstrong is a former state representative who was on the task force. She says the group tackled questions like how to make therapy accessible and how to offer safe and culturally competent care.
And the whole point of the task force was to bring up these types of questions so we're not scratching our head when this becomes medicalized and scrambling and being reactive, but we're actually being proactive about how we are approaching this.
The task force did not take a stance on whether psychedelic therapies are good or bad, but recommends Alaska incorporate them as they are legalized nationally. None of the recommendations are binding, but Armstrong says they're meant to guide legislators on the types of laws the state would need to offer access. Armstrong says the task force recommends incorporating a training program for therapists and healthcare providers who want to guide therapy.
Everyone needs to go through this type of training because just being a doctor doesn't make you qualified to facilitate this type of care.
and she says the aim is to make training accessible so a diversity of people can become certified. She says that would ensure people getting treated are a good fit with the person who guides them. Armstrong says Alaskans could benefit a lot from psychedelic therapies if they're legalized. That's because the state has such high rates of post-traumatic stress disorder, substance use disorders, and other mental illnesses. Psychedelic therapies are being studied to treat those disorders, and Armstrong says some of the research is promising.
There are so many folks who, through these trials, went from being suicidal and having treatment-resistant depression, unable to work, unable to function, to being in remission within months. Imagine how that can change how your neighbors and your friends and your family and your community can thrive.
She urges anyone with strong feelings about the topic to reach out to their legislators to share their thoughts. Well, the Supreme Court ruled last week that President Trump exceeded his authority when he imposed sweeping tariffs on nearly every country last April. Alaska Public Media's Ava White spoke with a trio of local entrepreneurs at the time who said the uncertainty they were facing was as damaging as the tariffs themselves. She revisited the three after the ruling, and while the business owners say it's a relief, they aren't celebrating yet.
The Supreme Court ruling came as a surprise to Liz Eldridge, owner of the Spice and Tea Exchange.
I was pleasantly shocked.
Her store in South Anchorage sells teas, sugars, and spices that are imported from dozens of countries. When Trump's so-called Liberation Day tariffs were announced last spring, Eldridge was suddenly faced with paying tariffs on almost everything she sells in her store. She was forced to stock up on items and change vendors. It was a complicated and expensive process that local business owners say took a huge toll on their companies. Now that the Supreme Court ruled those tariffs are illegal, they are expressing some relief, but skeptical they'll ever see a refund for the tens of thousands of dollars they've paid for tariffs. Eldridge says she's not counting on one, and she's not planning to pursue litigation either.
We'd be like an ant on an anthill. Like, there's millions of us, and we'd just be lost in the shuffle. I feel like I would be wasting my time for money I probably wouldn't get back.
Paxson Wolber feels similarly. He owns Ehrman Skate, an Anchorage company that makes the only Nordic skate on the market manufactured in the United States. Ehrman partners with manufacturers in South Central for the skate's ceramic coating and sharpening, but the company also imports safety gear from Scandinavian countries, which Wolber says has been the biggest tariff impact for his business.
I have no reason to actually think that I'm going to get it back right now. Or on what timeline? I mean, is Ehrman Skate, a little tiny Nordic skate making company in Alaska, going to be first in line to receive refunds on their unconstitutional tariff charges?
There's not a clear path to obtaining tariff refunds, according to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, even for large companies. Wolber declined to say how much the company has spent on tariffs in the last year, but says it's, quote, a significant five-figure number that forced the company to raise prices by about 15%. If the company gets a refund, Wolber says he would reinvest the money into his business by stocking up on products and upgrading machinery. He has wondered if getting that money back would allow him to refund customers or lower prices, but he says he can't even think that far ahead.
The amount of uncertainty in the system and the fact that I just have no idea if I'm even going to ever see a refund makes it really, really difficult to even think about doing that kind of thing.
Uncertainty is a feeling Eric Parsons has gotten used to over the last year. Parsons owns Revelate Designs, an Alaska-based bikepacking gear company. The company moved its manufacturing out of China last spring because of trade conditions. The company, Parsons says, has paid about $35,000 in reciprocal tariffs since they were implemented about a year ago. He says the turmoil has put the company in a conservative spending mindset and has taken an extreme psychological toll.
I think above all, it feels like an assault on small business and innovation.
He signed a letter in support of issuing businesses refunds, but Parsons says Revelate isn't in the financial position to hire an attorney to stand up to the federal government, and other small businesses are in the same boat. Even if Parsons were to get his tens of thousands of dollars spent on tariffs back, he says that doesn't put an end to the uncertainty.
Maybe we'll get refunds, but the president still wants to use tariffs as a controlling way for his foreign policy. So he's going to do that one way or the other. And so there's still going to be chaos and unpredictability.
Now, Trump implemented a new 10% global tariff, and the administration is trying to push it to 15%. Businesses say that just keeps them guessing and makes it harder to plan for the future. In Anchorage, I'm Ava White.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, already known for cold, Fairbanks shivers through its chilliest winter in more than a half century.
You know, so it's the old timers, you know, talk about what it used to be like. Well, that's what this winter is.
And that is ahead. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Avery Elfelt, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media, KHNS, where I work in Haines, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news on Alaska News Nightly or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
Authorities in Sand Point now believe a high school student who went missing after a canoe ride is dead. Kaipo Kamanunga has been missing since Monday night.
It's a recovery at this point.
That's Sand Point Chief of Police Benjamin Allen. He says a dive team from Anchorage was expected to arrive at the island community this morning. Until the dive team arrives, Allen says he and local volunteers have been the only ones searching. Sand Point is a small community of about 800 people that sits on the northwest side of Popoff Island near the western end of the Alaska Peninsula. Allen says Kamanunga and three other boys headed out to make s'mores and ride four-wheelers Monday afternoon at Red Cove Lake, which sits southwest of town. He says three of the boys hopped in a canoe they found by the lake.
While out, the canoe capsized. The fourth boy, who didn't go on the canoe, jumped on his four-wheeler, rode as fast as he could to get as close to him as he could. He stripped his clothes off and jumped in after him. He was able to get two of the boys to shore. The last time he saw Kaipo, he was face down in the water. And by the time he got the second boy back to shore, Kaipo was gone.
Kamanunga's disappearance has been hard on the small community, but Allen says he's been impressed with volunteers helping with the search, especially Kamanunga's own family. Locals have also organized a GoFundMe campaign for the boy's family. As of today, they've raised over $60,000. The city and borough of Juneau has reached a collective bargaining agreement with the union that represents Juneau Police 8 months after the last contract expired and a year after negotiations began. The Public Safety Employees Association and the city reached a tentative agreement earlier this month, and last night the assembly passed a resolution to ratify it. The new agreement includes a 3-5% annual wage increase for the next 3 years of the contract, as well as lump sum payments of between $2,000 and $2,750 for the next 2 years. In addition, the employer contribution for health insurance will see increases. Juneau police employees will also now get a day off for the Juneteenth holiday. The city made June 19th a city holiday last year. The city and the police union had been at an impasse since August. The agreement and pay increase come after the city released results from a survey that asked Juneau residents about budget priorities. Public safety, police, firefighting, and EMS, and schools were both in the top three priorities respondents chose. The city remains at an impasse with the union that represents the majority of Juneau firefighters. And the Juneau School District is also at an impasse with the teachers' union. An arbitration hearing is scheduled for April. Skagway, for decades, has contended with contamination left behind by mining companies that exported ore from its port. The last mine to move ore through Skagway shut down in 2023, but a newly formed company is courting the town in hopes of doing so again. As Avery Elfelt reports for the Alaska Desk, the development is raising questions about how to protect the local environment this time.
Skagway resident and vice mayor Deb Potter wasn't always aware that the town's port was contaminated.
I knew people who would go and catch shrimp right outside there, and the shrimp here is really good. So people are dropping me off shrimp at the bar and I'm trading them shrimp for drinks.
But she says that changed when
someone else is like, hey, you might not want to eat that.
The contamination dates back to the late 1960s, when the Faro Mine in Canada's Yukon Territory started shipping mineral concentrate to Skagway by rail, and then later by truck. Once in town, the material would be loaded onto ships docked at Skagway's ore terminal. for a number of years that happened on an open-air conveyor belt. It all resulted in elevated levels of lead, zinc, and other pollutants on land and in the water, according to the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. Here's Potter again.
So you basically just have lead, zinc product going everywhere. And then that just went on for years and years, if not decades.
A handful of mines and companies have owned, used, and operated the terminal over the years. The most recent user was Minto Mine, which closed in 2023 when its owners abruptly ceased operations, or hasn't been exported from Skagway since then. But that could soon change. A company known as Selkirk Copper is exploring restarting operations at Minto and routing the ore more than 200 miles south to Skagway. That's reignited discussions over the legacy contamination and how to ensure it doesn't get worse, says Skagway Mayor Orion Hansen.
There's certainly been a lot of legacy and residual contamination and, you know, uncertainty. You know, I think we have to be very, very pragmatic and cautious going forward that we're doing this in a safe way.
Earlier this month, Selkirk formally kickstarted that process in a draft letter of intent that's still being reviewed and negotiated with city officials. Here's Selkirk CEO Colin Jaudry during a recent Ports and Harbors Advisory Board meeting.
Our intention was exactly as been stated here. It was to start a discussion. It was not to get to an end game, neither quickly or without discourse.
The letter of intent outlines Selkirk's interest in working with Skagway to design and develop facilities that could be used to store, handle, and ship ore. There's currently an old ore shed that needs to be cleaned and renovated or potentially rebuilt. Selkirk's letter indicates the company would invest $300,000 toward that effort, plus up to $15 million for the broader facility. Here's Hansen again.
There is currently, you know, no conveyor or no way of loading a ship. We actually don't have a dock to do it from either. The wooden dock that's out there is not strong enough to do it, and it's really at the end of its lifespan.
Top of mind for everyone is how to ensure new operations don't fuel more contamination. In 2023, the Skagway Assembly passed an ordinance that says all ore that moves through the port must be in sealed containers to limit contamination. That's opposed to other systems, like conveyor belts that transfer loose material directly onto ships. During the February meeting, Jaudry of Selkirk said both approaches have pros and cons.
The whole intent of this discussion is to advance an analysis of that in a hopefully timely fashion, but we're not making that decision right now. We're advocating that that dialogue happen.
Hansen, the mayor, says restoring ore exports in Skagway would help diversify the tourism-dependent economy. He also thinks containerization may not be the best path forward and that there are environmental safeguards available today that weren't before. Others disagree. Andrew Cremata was mayor when the related ordinance passed. He thinks containerization is crucial. In the past, he says, a bunch of entities, including the mines and terminal operators,
has made a bunch of money, and they left all of this derelict infrastructure and contamination for taxpayers to pay for. And that's why it just sits there.
In a separate letter to local officials, Selkirk said it hopes to enter into an agreement with Skagway by the end of March. The ultimate goal, the letter says, would be to restart operations at Minto by mid-2028. Reporting in Haines, I'm Avery Elfelt.
U.S. military personnel launched a major field training exercise this week that'll take place in training areas around Alaska and in Greenland. The North American Aerospace Defense Command and the U.S. Northern Command are conducting the joint exercise called Arctic Edge 2026. It runs through March 13th. According to a news release, Arctic Edge will generate increased military activity and noise around Fairbanks, Anchorage, Kodiak, and Kotzebue. The news release said training also will be conducted in Greenland. That's despite recent statements by President Trump about his desire to acquire the Arctic island. According to the news release, all training activities in Greenland will be conducted in full coordination with Denmark. Anchorage leaders are doubling the city's capacity to clean up public parks, trails, and other spaces. Mayor Suzanne LaFrance announced at a press conference today that the city is adding a second 10-person crew to the Parks and Recreation Department's Healthy Spaces team. She calls the work essential.
They pick up everyday litter accumulated in our parks and along trails. They help restore green spaces where illegal camping has occurred. And they can remove heavy, illegally dumped items like appliances and mattresses that clutter our green belts.
LaFrance says the Healthy Spaces team removed over 2.4 million pounds of trash from public areas last year, roughly double the previous year's amount.
To put that in perspective, that is the equivalent weight of 30 humpback whales.
The expansion of the Healthy Spaces team is funded through a new $4 surcharge at the city's solid waste services facilities. Parks and Rec Director Shanna Gamble says the additional staff will allow the team to work year-round instead of seasonally and focus on areas beyond parks and trails.
Teams will be dispatched to multiple areas across the municipality in response to public reports, internally identified areas, camp cleanups, and coordination with APD on areas of concern.
The expansion of Anchorage's parks cleanup capacity comes after it criminalized most homeless camping in the city. Now that the city offers year-round shelter options, LaFrance says they haven't had to abate any large-scale camps this year.
We haven't needed to. As folks have camped in areas, we have done outreach and have new codes, too, that we can enforce. And by and large, folks comply and move on.
LaFrance says her administration doesn't anticipate a large influx of homeless camping in public spaces when the weather warms up in the spring. Anchorage residents can go to the city's website, muni.org, for a web portal to report illegal dumping or trash accumulation. The love of winter in Alaska's Golden Heart city of Fairbanks is likely waning for many residents. In a place known for cold, it's been downright frigid this winter. And on top of that, literally, an eye-popping amount of snow has fallen in Fairbanks. National Weather Service climate researcher Brian Brettschneider, back for another Ask a Climatologist segment, says even the hardiest of Fairbanks sourdoughs are struggling to remember a winter as cold and snowy.
This December through February period is going to be their coldest in over 50 years.
Wow.
You know, so it's the old timers, you know, talk about what it used to be like. Well, that's what this winter is. Well below normal temperatures, the number of negative 40 days, consecutive day streaks, you know, this and that. There's just no other way to describe it as anything other than a really cold winter for particularly the interior.
And you said for the winter, we're expecting it to be the coldest in 50 years. But what have they already seen? I mean, remind me, because there have been some superlatives already this winter for Fairbanks, right?
Well, really, the most noteworthy thing is the number of minus 40 degree days, right? And so today, as we're recording this, it's the 22nd day of the winter that they've hit minus 40, and it's very likely to have two more such days. And that's the most of any winter in the previous 53 years. So we're going to be up to about 24, and no other winter in that period has had as many as 20. It's not a record, all-time record, which would be quite a number of more days, back in the 1920s and 30s. But this is really noteworthy for how many of the really deep cold days there's been compared to the last half century.
I feel like it can't go unsaid that along with the cold, that's been a pretty snowy winter in Fairbanks. And just recently here, too, they've had even more snow. And I had seen some graphics about it was the most in this particular time period. Maybe you can fill me in on that.
Yeah, a lot of times we think about the really cold winters as maybe not having a lot of snow just because you have either high pressure or a northerly flow where there's not much moisture. But, you know, not only has it been so cold, as you noted, this month, the month we're currently in, February, is the second snowiest February on record, 38.7 inches. And it's in the top 10 for snowiest any month. Usually the snowiest months tend to be earlier in the winter and less so toward the spring where it's traditionally the drier season. So really, really a remarkable amount of snow. And that brings the season total now up to almost 90 inches. You know, a normal season has about 65. So already about 25 inches above normal if it doesn't snow again the rest of the winter, and it probably will. Once you get another 6 inches, it'll be the snowiest season in over 30 years for this century.
Now, humans are always trying to search for some, you know, greater meaning in these things, and including in Fairbanks. And I wonder, is it snowier in Fairbanks, climatologically speaking, you know, this winter and past winters, and why is that?
So this is really an outlier. So for Fairbanks, as far as the snow goes this winter, there's been a couple of snowy winters in the last decade, 15 years, but there's also been some winters that didn't have a lot. So there's not really a trend that people should be kind of reading into this. It's worth also noting that up until the last week or so, much of the interior, particularly Western Alaska, has been almost in a snow drought. There's been much less snow than normal in most of the western half of the mainland. Now they're getting caught up as best they can in the last week or 10 days with a couple of storms. But prior to that, many people in the state were talking about how little snow there had been this winter.
Interesting. Now, I guess, you know, turning away from Fairbanks, how have things shaped up across the state this winter?
In much of the mainland, it's been, for snow, it's been a low snow winter compared to recent winters statewide. So, you know, if you look at the map of who's above and who's below normal, there's a lot of places that are below normal. And the previous few winters had a lot of places that were above normal. Now, statewide, as far as the temperatures go, this has certainly been a cold winter. We're kind of on par with, maybe slightly warmer than the winter of 2019-20. But that winter aside, this will be the coldest winter in about 25 years. So, you know, this century. So it's, again, another winter where it's looking like, you know, something that was common pre, say, 1975. This would be a middle-of-the-pack winter. But for, you know, for the last five decades, this is an unusually cold winter.
That was National Weather Service climate researcher Brian Brettschneider, the climatologist in our Ask a Climatologist segments. And that is all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Theo Greenlee in Portland, Rachel Cassandra, Ava White, and Wesley Early in Anchorage, Maggie Nelson in Unalaska, Yvonne Crumry in Juneau, Avery Elfelt in Haines, and Tim Ellis in Delta Junction. Our audio engineer tonight is Dave Waldron. Kirsten Dobroth is our producer. And I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
If you are an Alaska resident interested in preserving subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing for future generations, consider applying to serve on a Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council for an opportunity to have direct input into the federal subsistence regulatory process. Apply by April 2nd. More information at doi.gov/subsistence/regions or call 800-478-1456. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.